We are back with It Feels Right. Adam Stone's back in the studio today. My God, it's good to see his beautiful face. We're going to be going over a lot of MLP mechanics, what's happening, what the draft looks like, how the bidding process works, and much more.
Yeah, we got the tip of the day talking about how to defend the shake and bake, a pretty hot topic lately, and a light preview of the PPA and North Carolina coming up this weekend.
Let's get it.
Because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary.
Ladies and gents, before we hop into the show, I do want to talk to you a little bit about Selkirk's amazing line of pickleball nets. And whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned pro, Selkirk has the perfect net for you. When you choose a Selkirk net, you're not just choosing any net, you're opting for the official net of the PPA Tour, where excellence meets professional play. With Selkirk's line of nets, you can play pickleball anywhere. Selkirk's range of nets caters to every player's needs, offering budget-friendly choices for casual enthusiasts and premium options for those with a competitive edge that are looking for more of the pro-level net. So either way, you're ensuring quality play for all levels, and I've got a Selkirk net for myself, and let me tell you, it's a game changer. It's all about playing on your terms wherever you are, whether it's the driveway or on the PPA Tour. So if you love pickleball as much as I do and we do here at It Feels Right podcast, check out Selkirk's pickleball nets. Get the freedom to play anywhere and everywhere and elevate your game with the net trusted by the pros. Selkirk's got you covered. If you're interested in getting a net of your own, go to selkirk.com/collection/nets and we'll link to that in the show notes. You can also find this link in the description of the show. But let's jump into this week's episode of It Feels Right with Robin Stone.
Ding, 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 ding.
There it is.
Adam Stone is back in the studio. You know, we missed you. We missed you last week. We had Abraham Dinkin fill in, which, you know, he's not you, but he is him. And he's a unique little character. Greg Dowell came and said, "What's up?" It's just been a smorgasbord. That's a tough word, first thing. I literally got caught in like the bottom of my throat.
Cornucopia.
Cornucopia.
I've been doing some thesaurus work, you know, because I talk about the same thing for 20 hours per weekend. So you got to mix in some different words at times.
What do you have for, I need you to come up with a new thing at 8-all. Because if I hear Dave Fleming say double snowman one more time, I might lose my mind.
And now I've like started just to roll with it, and I'll like set him up. When he doesn't do it, I'll be like, "Dave, what are you doing?" And that encourages him more.
Dave,
I'm into it. I'm into it. Like, it's gotten to a point, and so many people talk about it that I want more. Actually,
I know.
I think some people want less. I want more. I want more.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's one or the other. It's either like, let's just make a complete, like, let's just be completely silly about this and go that way, or let's just stop it. But I like it. I like that route.
Yeah, no, I think that's the play. And clearly, I need to give a big thank you to Abraham Dinkin, Eric Hot Toddy Roddy, and Greg Dow. And I mean, Abraham Dinkin is clearly amazing, but I actually think the flow of Thomas Jefferspin is just a bit better. Like, it just rolls right. It's like you almost don't even have to adjust the name at all when you go with Thomas Jefferspin.
It's smooth. It's smooth. Fight the Eisenpower is not bad either.
I just couldn't even imagine just sitting around with, you know, a case of beer with a couple of guys and just talking about presidents and historical figures that match up with pickleball terms. It's just too good.
Harriet Tubman. I mean, dude, he's the man.
I'm crying a little bit early in the episode.
And
it's
the
so good.
The good. I used to follow his. I didn't used to, but he stopped doing this. He posts on Twitter quite a bit, or X, whatever we call it now. And he used to just always post like random pictures and be like, "Wow, great! This would be a great spot for a pickleball court. It would be like the entrance to the Bank of America building in Charlotte, of just like a front line. Like, whoa, wow, this would be a great spot for
this." Would,
dude, he's funny.
Would be. Yeah,
he's funny. No,
it's good fill-ins. Yeah, well, I wasn't, you know, I kind of wasn't available, and then you pulled something out of your back pocket, and man, you picked a couple quality guest hosts.
I mean, it's all credit to them because it was in the moment, and Roddy was like, I'm dinking right now, as Abraham Dinkin should be dinking,
yeah,
but I could be on there in 45 minutes, so just give me a second.
I mean, he's grinding, but he'll make time. He'll make time. Love that.
But now back to regularly scheduled programming with Robin Stone.
Oh, yeah. Here we are. Man, there's a lot going on. Always. There always is. Have we ever been on here and there has not been a lot going on? We have these like dead space segments that we might squeeze in here and there, and there's just no time for it, Robert, because in the pickleball landscape, it's a show, and there is a lot of good, a little bad, a little ugly, just everything that you could ever want in terms of information and newsworthy topics.
But you know what's not ugly, Adam? Well, one, your hairline, because it's perfect. But two, the little guy here in the background, which is Mr. AJ, and those Easter pictures were, I mean, I'm just like, oh my, I was like, that is the cutest kid. Like his little smile with his little teethies pointing out, and he's like kind of leaning back.
Yeah.
God, dude. Yeah, and I know you said I know you said he's, and I believe, I 100% believe that, but the way that little creature looks makes up for all of it in my book. I know I'm not the one waking up in the middle of the night or doing the car rides and the crying, but I'm here for those pictures. Keep posting.
No, he's a cutie. So five quality minutes makes up for the other 23 plus hours of the day. But you know, everyone knows that that's how it goes. But I could not agree more. When he gets all dolled up and he's in a good mood, he's pretty dang cute. So
that little outfit he's wearing, dude, my God, the little Easter bunnies on it. Jeez.
Seersucker. So I didn't even really know what that was, but
that's the blue and white stripes, right? Or no?
Blue and white stripes, little textured fabric, Easter pastels, the whole shebang was going on. So I can't complain. It was a lovely Easter Sunday.
What'd you do?
So we went to the Country Club of North Carolina where Corinne's parents live and had a lovely brunch. And
what'd you guys talk about at brunch?
Well, all kinds of things, really.
You guys talk about pickleball a lot at the brunch table?
Yeah, well, Corinne was a pretty big part of getting courts the Country Club. So there, you know, there's the classic Country Club battle. You got the golfers, the tennis players, and then people want the pickleball. And so there was several ladies that lived there, including Corinne's mother and Corinne, that kind of put the foot on the gas and made it happen. And they got four lovely courts kind of overlooking the lake. So it's a spot, man. It's a spot.
Speaking of courts, obviously AJ's throwing a wrench in a lot of stuff, but it doesn't matter because he's so cute. And like I said, keep posting those pictures. But yeah. do we have a complex compound stone pickleball center in the future?
It's not going to be in the near future. So we have a lovely plot of land, but there is a pretty dang serious slope on it in the back. And it really aesthetically looks wonderful, but to build a flat pickleball court is not ideal. So we're talking retaining wall situation and a lot of money. So
yeah,
definitely not a hard no, but it's gonna take a little bit of time if we are to go that route. So it is sad, but there's plenty of other things we need to do.
You just built it on the slope?
What do you mean you just built it on the slope?
Just built it on the slope. What do you mean? What I mean, you just have you just lay the concrete on the slope. Forget the retaining wall. Just we can have an uphill downhill battle. I mean, you switch sides every game anyways.
Yes, talk about a side advantage. You know, you got. I don't think that would work.
That would be fun though. Like, which side do you think is the advantage? Playing uphill or downhill?
Man, you can't keep that ball in downhill.
It'd be tough.
Like what are you going to do? I mean,
and you're going to fall in the kitchen a lot if you're downhill on a decent slope.
Oh yeah, you got. I mean, I didn't think we were going this route.
And think about the lobs you could hit when you're going uphill.
I mean, you could just let it fly. And
downhill, you cannot even think about a lob.
No, I think you have to go uphill. I think that's the play for sure. I think downhill you have no shot. I mean, it's similar to wind. I don't like playing with the wind. It's difficult.
But if you get that high ball on the downhill, I mean, that thing's not coming back. You know what I mean?
It's all over. It's going to hit and skid. That's right. So you just lob and beam.
That would be, this is, you know, tennis has clay courts, pickleball has slanted courts. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, let's just segue this lovely conversation into the tip of the day and start off with a bang. What do you think,
Rob? I thought we just did it. If you're playing on an uphill court, you lob.
No, that wasn't quite it, but that maybe that's for another day is with the wind and against the wind strategy.
Yeah.
But I think we're just gonna talk a little bit about defending the shake and bake, Rob.
Oh, so, I like this. This is super important. And
yeah.
It's where Andre and I, like, when we lose games, it's usually because of a team's shake and bake.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of teams that are very quality at it. And I think at the lower levels, you have a lot of not the most skilled players, but they're very athletic coming from other sports. A lot of the age of the average player is coming down. Lots of players in their 20s, very athletic ladies and fellas. So getting in those quick points can be tough to get out of. And I think it's really important to talk about some strategy. And I think that actually, yeah, so I think that there's been a lot of talk about, well, hey, they're hitting harder. They have better spin. Players have better offense. Well, it's easy. Kitchen to kitchen, we'll just get out of the way and let the ball go out. One, the balls are staying in more frequently. And two, when they're hit with more spin and more pace, I think there is a ton of players, especially in those mid-levels, that are not – it's not an option to get out of the way. It really isn't.
Yeah.
I will say, in terms of third shot drives and shake and bake, I still think you have plenty of time and extra time that letting balls go out really is a great option from that point. Granted, there is more spin, so you have to be careful, and that ball has got to be, you know, where it was maybe shoulder high, you know, a couple years ago. Now it might be head high or higher to where that ball's not going to go in with the amount of spin some of these paddles are getting. So,
yeah, it's one of the – I know, Adam, you mentioned, like, early on when we were playing together, like in Rec in Austin, that, you know, you recognized that I was – decent at like recognizing balls that were going to go out. I feel like that's changed quite a bit, and I find myself struggling with it based on what the paddles can do now. Like I feel like I've lost my gauge to an extent on what the ball is doing when it's head high, because there's been so many times where that ball is going in, whereas in, you know, a couple years ago, there's absolutely no chance. You see trajectory and swing, like how big it is, and you're like, okay, you can feel pretty confident that's going out. But now it's much more difficult.
Yeah, and it creates indecision too.
Yeah,
which leads to less crisp first volleys and more unforced errors on first volleys as well, because you're kind of hesitating or second guessing yourself. So that's always letting the ball go out is always going to be a work in progress. And it's, I don't care if you're whatever, Andre Dayescu or whoever, it's just not something that's easy to do. So,
yeah.
And then of course, really the main thing is court positioning on your first volley and what you're doing with that first volley. That is the most important thing in my eyes. So, of course, getting tight to the kitchen and not making contact with that first volley in the transition zone, which is very difficult given some of the serves and pace and spin on the drives these days. But it is definitely something that is huge for how the point is going to unfold. So, you know, maybe it could be court positioning when you return. Maybe it's the height of your return and the depth of your return that allows you to get forward. But being to the line is just so important when defending the shake and bake.
Yeah, I would say getting to the line is more important than hitting a heavy return. Like, you don't want the return to be short and high, because then you're just going to get blasted. But like if you hit kind of a floaty return deep, like I feel like getting to the kitchen and being set is more important than cranking your return and being a foot off the line, if that makes sense.
No, I do. And, you know, with the spin created on the third shot drives, it kind of neutralized some of those returns too. Now, of course, we want them driving on their back foot. There's a lot of good things that come from that, but you just blast away and hit a great thing. Players, especially ex-tennis players, on their back foot can still create some rotation on the ball with just being low to high with some of the grab that the paddles have these days. So also on that first volley, court positioning, but what are you doing with the first volley? So I mean, always I'm just hit it clean, punch it solid, have a nice compact stroke, but really kind of go after it and pin that player back deep. And try to avoid the player that's poaching or baking, if you will. So I'm thinking that in certain situations, granted, this is a very difficult shot, but taking a bit of pace off of that first volley is going to be something that we're seeing at the higher levels, and almost kind of conceding the kitchen when you are playing a team that is hot with the drive and the poach. If you're just constantly trying to pump that first volley back deep to the player that drove the ball, these guys are too athletic these days.
A good poacher's all over.
A good poacher is going to be able to pick so many of those off, especially with the spin created on the third shot. You're often hitting that first volley up and not kind of down or through the court as frequently. So I think that kind of deadening the ball, and you don't even have to necessarily drop it in the kitchen, but don't give them that shot or that opportunity to pick the ball off when they're poaching, when the ball is waist or above, because they're just too good at it. And it can really, like you said, Rob, have a string of points where just it's 2 minutes and you've lost 4, 5, 6 points off that shake and bake strategy. So just a couple of things that I'm thinking, and this is a constant work in progress strategically, and we'll see how a lot of the teams kind of adapt and if they mix in some of these strategies with the shake and bake, because almost everybody's good at it now.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because oftentimes they're taking pace off the drive, and it's more of like a three-quarter dipper that you're taking from your shin. And if you try to, or even like, let's call it your waist, like let's call it net level high, you're still not able to like really hit down on that. So if you volley it hard and hit through it, it's still got, I mean, that volley is going to be waist level for your opponent, which is going to be a very poachable ball. So I think that's a smart, we are seeing that more, where if you're getting that ball kind of waist or below, you're seeing guys, just kind of deaden that volley. And like you said, Adam, conceding the kitchen, because like when I'm thinking about playing a good shake and bake team, all I'm talking about with my partner is all we have to, because typically I feel like, versus a shake and bake team, we're going to win points at the kitchen. They're going to win free points on shake and bake. They're going to hit good drives. They're going to poach. We're going to miss some volleys, that kind of thing. So in my head, all it ever is against those teams is weather the storm, the first two shots, the serve and their third, weather that, get to the kitchen, concede the kitchen, let them come in. Because even though we're the return team and we should have the advantage, if we get to the kitchen and they get to the kitchen, we should still have the advantage. So I think for an amateur out there thinking about it, and you're playing a really good shake and bake team, just weather the storm, weather those first two shots. And you have to get, like, the thing I see the most is you have to get to the kitchen line off the return. Period. End of story. I don't care what happens. There's too many times where the returner is not getting to the kitchen line. And I think if you focus on nothing else but hitting a return and getting to the kitchen line, that will solve a lot of problems, because there's so many first volleys I'm seeing from 3 feet behind the line, and you're hitting it at your shoestrings when you could be hitting it at your waist.
Yeah. And I've kind of figured a little something out by accident. I'm, pretty freakishly out of shape these days. So when I do play rec, I've been playing, two or three times a month, something like that. I've been short hopping my returns. And I'm not even necessarily suggesting other people do that, but I've found myself right on the kitchen line for my next volley, So I think there's probably some players with skill sets that can do the short hop thing. But I think the same situation is, if it's floaty and deep, it doesn't matter. It literally doesn't matter. If it's floaty and short, that's an issue. But if it's deep landing in the back,
it's actually better, because they don't have pace to use from you.
Yeah, I agree. So I have found with my traditional returns that I was not making it in my accelerated age. And I went to the short hop, and there's, a couple variations of the short hop. And I found myself right on the kitchen line for first volleys and handling drives much better than when I was hitting a more traditional return. So
I like that a lot. And also,
it's a huge factor. And
we're both short hoppers.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we're both short hoppers. Short hopping is good on thirds too. I think it's underrated on thirds. Truly. Like, if you can dial that in, it's like hitting a good mid-court reset. Sometimes that return will come kind of to the mid-court, and you're getting down and you're short hopping it, and you're right into the kitchen first ball. So I think that's like an underused, tactic as well. Short hop for the win.
Yeah. And this is, I know these are not easy skills to master, but this is I mean, some of these matches I'm seeing, pro level, 4-0 level, whatever it may be, I mean, we're talking 70, 80, 90% of the points are quick hitting points. So I know the skill sets aren't easy and the strategies aren't easy to execute, but we, I mean, we got to start talking about a variety of different ways to counteract what's happening and where the game is headed. So I think a few of those are pretty quality, and maybe grab one that makes sense with your skill set and try to work on that in your rec play moving forward.
Adam, what are your thoughts on, we talked about this a little bit last week with Roddy and Dow, and you know, Dow's not always known for the best takes per se, but he had a thought that I really liked, and I think it could make a lot of sense just in terms of technology in the game and where we're headed. If we're, you know, if we're going to stay on this trajectory of the game being fast and faster and faster, I think it removes a lot of the strategy in a sense, like, you know, the longer points, and not everybody wants longer points. So it's a, you know, it's, again, it's a philosophical question on where people want the game to go. But his thought was, let's just get wild with spin. Let's kind of remove some limits on the spin or open it up a little bit more, and let's dial the power way back. And then you can, like, you're looking at, you know, big, like really dippy drops, but not like crazy fast. Mm-hmm. You can do really interesting angles, pull people off the court. You can flick balls that wouldn't normally go in, but now they're going in. So it still creates like a really interesting element to the game, but I think it keeps the game more true to how it was originally intended.
No, I like that a lot. And, you know, it doesn't, there's no way it was ever just going to be like 2018 and just stay that way. It's not an option, but I do like the spin component more. There's a big argument for both, you know, because it's like, whatever, like in NCAA, when we're doing the NCAA tournament right now, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's, you know, backdoor cuts and give and go and, you know, box and one zone and full press and all this stuff going on. And it's moving more towards, this guy's just more athletic and more physically.
I think it's so boring, men's basketball.
Yeah, that's
now.
So I know faster is good for viewing, and it is. It's fun. It creates some interesting points, some scrambling, some hectic stuff. But you have to find that balance of keeping the chess aspect and the strategic aspect in play. And I think dialing down the power and adding some extra spin could be a good way to do that. I mean, I remember those, you know, you'd have the whatever, the lower seeded teams, and they're just kind of figuring out how to do it. And now it's just, my guy's tall, he can shoot threes, my guy is this, and he's better than your guy. So it's just, it's less appealing from a viewership perspective for me anyway.
Yeah, I think it's gone to, like you said, yeah, it's gone to, like when I watch men's basketball, for example, it's like, they do like an isolation every trip down the court. Mm-hmm. It's like they put their best player on the ball, the best defender, and the other four guys on the court are literally just standing around creating room. It's like, that's the strategy now. Mm-hmm. And it might be the reason why women's basketball is being watched more and more outside of course, you know, the generational athlete, Caitlin Clark. I mean, that's the main reason we all know, but women's basketball, they're playing real basketball, you know, off the ball, they're moving, they're cutting, they're setting picks. They're like you said, Adam, like kind of showing different defensive looks. Like it's truly like there's more going on, and it's more interesting to watch because you're seeing like how they're trying to solve different problems. Like even if you put four players on Caitlin Clark, it doesn't matter. She's still going to drop 32 and she's going to have 16 assists. It doesn't matter. You can't stop a generational athlete. So this is the problem that women's, you know, they run into trying to guard generational athletes. And it's a more interesting sport. And I'm going to say generational athlete one more time, Caitlin Clark.
That's four.
And just, Adam, I don't know if I've told you this, but I'm also, you know, Malin and I are now Indiana Fever season ticket holders. I didn't get as far as like how we're going to get to the games, which games we're going to get to. But I do know that we are Indiana Fever season ticket holders. And not just that, Adam, but we've got pretty good seats. So there's a lot happening in terms of Caitlin Clark right now. She's playing tonight against LSU. I'm incredibly stressed out about it because I have an incredible disdain for Kim Mulkey, their head coach. It's an unhealthy dislike at this point. But I think that's my good little rant for women's basketball. Thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Yeah, I was going to cut Clark, you off, but generational athlete. That's five. Okay, so we hit the five spot on that, and I'm on the Twitter, so I got a little. I know the Mulkey thing, and there's some like New York Times article about her or something,
a hit piece. She's such a baby,
and then
dude.
This Angel Reese, is that her name? The LSU player. That's Angel pretty great Reese, as well. Yeah. So yeah, I'm a little in the mix there. So yeah. Just a little pivot over to ladies basketball. Some good points there.
I mean,
five,
that's
good.
Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, I'll just leave it there. I've got a lot more I could say, but I'll just leave it there. So that's the tip. Weather the storm.
Well, Robert, we have a couple pretty important drafts coming up for Major League Pickleball.
There's a lot.
We have the premier draft Tuesday night, Wednesday evening, Challenger, and this is supposedly or hopefully, I'm not exactly sure what your word to use, that these will be the only drafts moving forward, and then we'll have some form of free agency and trading and moving around of the pieces of the Premier and the Challenger level teams moving forward. And I hope that's what happens. Things change so quickly, you never know. But it's pretty wild. So the Premier League is going to be an auction level draft where you actually draft, you bid for a specific draft slot. When you earn that draft slot by bidding, then you pick a player. So it's very unique. When you say bid for,
I'm going to probably be asking a lot of questions here because
I'm not super
familiar with the mechanics of all of this. So I'm going to be probably asking a fair amount of clarifying questions. So when you say bid for a draft slot, are you talking about real money in terms of these teams and MLP owners putting up real dollars to be able to see, like to be able to get where, like if they want the number one draft pick, that team's putting up the most money to get that pick?
Well, you get 500K Monopoly money. And
but
then
that's
you have
for
the,
your draft pick, right?
That's just every team gets that going into the draft.
Got it.
And then you have the option to purchase an extra $500,000 to cap your overall money at $1 million to play with. Okay.
How do you get that extra 500K?
You pay for it.
How much?
You pay for it. The dollar value. Yeah.
So you could pay an extra 500K to get that 1 million cap.
That is correct. Yes, that is correct. So
is that what also determines draft slot, or what determines draft slot? Like how did the number one, who's drafting number one in Premier?
Oh, we don't know yet. So we get to the draft and there is a bid for the first overall pick. It's not even a player. You bid for the pick with all the other teams, and you have that. It kind of goes online and it goes through this interface, and you end up, if you secure the pick, say you get the first pick, then you can pick whoever you want to.
But that bid happens during the draft or before?
During the draft. So there will be, okay, pick number two. Everybody goes, and then the team that earns it has 2 minutes to pick the actual player that they want.
And that's real money being bid.
No, it's just
for the draft slot. I mean, okay, so that's part of your cap.
That is part of your cap. That is correct. So that dollar value is not attached to the player at all. That doesn't really mean anything. That's just the money each team has to work with to kind of work out the draft. So the contract stuff, all of that stuff, is what the player is earning and kind of what they're getting. That money attached to them through the draft is just money for the draft, so that everyone is on a somewhat level playing field, basically.
But to be clear, the bid, like the amount you're bidding for that draft slot, comes from your cap.
It comes from your cap. That is correct. So
okay. The bid and like the draft pick. So it's all it's all debiting from that cap you have.
That's right. So okay, if you started, say every team starts with $1 million. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah,
that's right. You bid $900,000 on the first pick. You have $100,000 to work with for your other three picks. So there is a lot of, usually these draft strategies and auction, which I was lucky to do a lot of them in baseball. It's, do you have a more balanced middling team, or do you go stars and scrubs, where you get two heavy hitters and then you just kind of fill in? It's called dollar days at the end of the draft, where you can almost get min priced players and to kind of fill in your roster. So
yep.
it's very dynamic and every draft room is different. Some people just go crazy with their first pick, and then some people kind of pull back and you can get some value there early on. So you have to be very fluid as a GM in these drafts and make sure you're available to adapt to the room.
And this, I mean, that kind of, and my questions are probably going to make us pop around here, but based on just looking at that number one draft slot, I mean, is that going to be like a lock to be Ben, or is it, because I know there's situations with different players that they're not required to play all the events. Some might play four, or some might play three. So what's that look like?
Almost all of them are six. I think there's a couple. These are the PPA signed players that had six in their contract. And the schedule this year for MLP is five regular season events, one regular season tournament, and then two postseason events. So yes, you have to do, as a team, you have to do due diligence. So there's a lot of contact with owners and GMs, with the players, kind of feeling out the vibe. Some players are no big deal, I'll do what the team needs. Some players are going to stick to their contract, and that's absolutely their right. So there is a variety of different contracts and a lot of moving parts to the draft, and just kind of knowing who is going to stick to their six and who is willing to play a couple more. And this, I think this plays in more in 2025 as well. We're kind of in a prorated situation here with half a season. So next year, I'm not sure exactly the number of events that they're looking for, but it's going to be more than this year.
But that's interesting, right?
They have a whole year. So
that's interesting because, you know, most of these contracts for the PPA signed players are 3-year contracts, right? So if they're, you know, if they're on six events, yeah, they'll be able to play all of them in 24. But like, is that something, you know, you as a GM, for example, are thinking about in 2025? Like, yeah, we get this pick for 2024 and they have to play all of them, but maybe they only play half next year. Like, that's is that a real concern for a lot of GMs?
Okay,
yeah.
No, one for 2 years, and then one player from your team must go into the, you have to drop one player and put that into a free agent pool. So you're not even, that's right. So you're not even, it's not even possible to keep all four of your players, but you can keep three of them, two for 3 years, one for 2 year. And then you have that one player that must go into the free agent pool to just kind of, I like this to not
keep,
be able to just
to keep it fresh, to keep like
fresh.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
fresh. Yeah. And so you give, if a team drafted poorly, you give them a shot to dig into the free agent pool and have a little switcheroo with their squad. So I like that. And I know it is very confusing, and I totally get that. And I think most fans, you know, the diehards, probably a lot of people listening to this show, are very interested in that, and some, you know, just want to see the play and the format and all that good stuff. So yeah. So
any what's the trade situation?
So you can trade. I probably should know a little bit more specifics on that, but yes, you can trade, and that's very available. And you can trade
at any time.
If you have a certain waiver wire priority, you can use cash and you can use waiver wire priorities for the trades as well. So, like we talked about that free agent pool, you have to drop somebody. If you have the number one spot and there's a new up and comer or something, you can trade that for value to another team. So
yep.
there's a lot going on, and yeah, hopefully these rules kind of stick and hold throughout this, you know, next couple years, and they become a little more smoother for everyone to understand. But I like a lot of what they're doing. I do.
Yeah. It seems like it's on the right track for sure. Can you trade from, like, one thing that I wish they didn't have was two different divisions, Premier Challenger. I wish it was just, MLP's a league and you have, call it two divisions, North or East and West, whatever. But it's all the top level, if that makes sense. So it's just all Premier, 24 teams.
Right.
And And you spread talent out a little bit more, obviously, and you have people playing, you know, you have the best player playing with, you know, oftentimes the lowest ranked player in the league. But are you going to be able to trade from Premier to Challenger and vice versa?
Yes, I believe so. And like, I mean, I had, it was Zoom call and a couple of conversations I've had on the phone, and I have some notes on it that aren't with me. So I don't want to give out any false information, but I believe that's how I understood it, is that yes, you can trade throughout the year and between leagues as well.
Yeah. What's the, and I don't know if you know this, but Ann Wooster in the Racket X panel said that there's many owners looking to sell, which I found it to be an interesting comment. Just sharing that several owners want it out, I found to be interesting. But what is kind of the, you know, obviously the merger happened. Some people didn't want the merger to happen in terms of owners. Some did. It obviously happened. Is there a lot of like, are there upset owners that, you know, that, I mean, clearly there's owners that want out. And is that based on the merger happening and the direction that MLP has chosen to go?
Absolutely no idea. I know the valuations of the teams went up after the merger, but I am, you know, I'm not in that deep to know that. I'm kind of more, you know, focused on the player pool and some of the rules and the format of play. I'm just not sure from like an ownership buzz perspective, like what the boys are chatting about or what sure. they were hoping to happen. No, sure. I'm serious.
I'm just messing with you. I'm just messing with you. No,
I really don't.
That was a question that I knew you wouldn't be able to answer, but I thought I'd ask you.
Well, why did you ask it, Robert? You know that that's not my style right there. And I do have some good tidbits and, you know, some juicy gossip here and there. But I'm more worried about some of the format, and we're going full rally scoring as well. Games to 25, no freeze whatsoever. So there is zero freeze, you know, no 18, no one team can catch back up. Just full send.
Have to win on your serve.
Rally scoring, playing to 25. So that's a new little wrinkle, and a couple other things as well in terms of a rules perspective that nothing's grabbing me right now in my brain. But I like that too. I think that's another thing tough to follow, you know, as a casual viewer. You know, the diehards, they know these things, but a casual viewer with the freeze and this happening and that happening. And also I think that there was maybe some difficulty in terms of betting or setting lines or something like that when you have a freeze involved. So I think this, for the grand scale, makes some good sense.
Yeah. I'd be curious on what the thoughts are from everybody out there listening in terms of the MLP format now, and whether it's, you know, we've had a big break with MLP and we've missed several events already this year. Is everybody still excited? Is there still like kind of the buzz and like, are people pumped, especially with all the opt-outs? Because, you know, quite a few, you know, the Johnson Five are not in the draft pool to my knowledge, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think you haven't played an event for a handful of months. I think there is a dip of that just not being on the forefront of mind. But I think once you get back on court, team format, and, you know, everything starts rolling again, I don't think it's going to take long for this gap to be in the rearview mirror. I could be wrong, but I think it's going to be, like just a couple events in, it's going to be like nothing ever happened. And it's going to kind of hold its, you know, what it had and some of the team aspect that made it really great to begin with. I think it's going to hold on to that personally.
Well, I agree. And I think the format is what does that. It's fun. I mean, even having even this podcast being mostly about updates to MLP and like what the people like that stuff, you know, people like thinking about who's going to get drafted where based on the mechanics of this. Mm-hmm. And that it's there's so many more interesting talking points than just a typical tournament weekend.
Yeah. Both are good.
Are good.
The mix of both is what it should be. I don't know what the perfect mix is, but I couldn't agree more. Standard tournaments are great. Team format's great. If you find that perfect balance between the two, that's got to be the ideal situation.
I mean, I think the ideal situation is.
Uh-oh, here we go.
I've always said it. I've always said it. I agree. There needs to be both, but I don't like the fact that they're kind of like on top of each other, like connected. I wish that it was like I've always said, like a true team-based league where, you know, you're playing for your city and your team. You have home and away matches. You get the local community more involved and behind the team. Because I think that's a people want to get connected to, you know, where they're from, and they want to support the local team. And I think you don't have that connect if, you know, if your team's just always, if your team has nothing to do with the city that the team's based out of, you know,
you got to get there. You got to get there. So I'm not quite there yet, but I mean, man, all this stuff is so young. So in its infancy, you know, it's just a work in progress. I saw someone, I don't know who it was, something on X, whatever you want to call it. And I liked this idea, a staggered dream breaker.
Meaning what?
Like one team puts out, whoever it may be, coin toss situation. One team puts out a player for 4 points. Other team puts out a player for 2. And then it starts regularly after that. So you get, you basically have to have females versus females, men versus men, and you must have men versus females in the dream breaker, which I think, I thought that could be pretty cool. Because no one, players, fans, everyone loves it when it's a guy versus a girl matchup in a dream breaker. That is a fan favorite. And that was kind of a little tweak that maybe could make that happen more often.
Yeah, I like that. What they did at the Indian Open was a little different for the dream breaker as well. They did it wasn't singles. It was each of the four events. That's what rotated. So women's doubles would play. You could put out the lineup however you wanted. So you could have a mixed team playing a women's team, or you could have, you know, the men playing the women. Same thing, but just doubles, which I found to be pretty interesting. So, you just put out your lineup of like, we're gonna do women's, then we're going to do mixed, then men's, then the other mix, and you just play the doubles points all the way through to 21.
No, yeah, it's a
there's lots of open, variations. It would be
lots
cool
of
to,
variations.
It would actually be cool to mix it up from event to event, because it's a, you know, it's not like an advantage for, it's an advantage to the doubles teams, or you know, the doubles teams where you don't have, call it, good singles players, so they're weaker on the single side. There's obviously a clear advantage to the doubles teams there, but I think it'd be fun to mix it up.
Yeah, no, I agree. And still tweaks almost every time there's something slightly different, or, you know, just trying to get it right and find that perfect balance like we talked about. So work in progress. And I think it's really grown leaps and bounds, and we're headed in the right direction with everything now.
Is Challenger the same kind of the same mechanics as Premier, or what's that look like?
The Challenger is a full snake draft. Just okay. A regular standard
so
snake
no
draft.
Bidding,
you get
anything.
No bidding. You just go back and forth. And, you know, they were talking about having deeper rosters, but it is to 4. So they were talking about having 6 in Challenger. But it is going to be 4, a standard snake draft. And you know, of course, prepping
Sorry,
for
Greg
that draft.
He was hoping for 6. He was hoping for six.
Oh, that's so good. So standard snake, like I said, and the Hard Acher drafting in the 9 spot. So,
especially in Challenger, that's a great spot for Challenger.
Yeah, I like it. So you don't really have to pick the last handful of picks, which, you know, is nice. Of course, it's going to be thinner in the back of the draft. So, you know, you get that top couple pick. It's exciting. You can get a stud or a big time lady, but, you know, deep in the draft, sometimes the options aren't super sexy, you know?
What determined draft order for Challenger?
I have no idea. I just know that my boy Tim let me know that we had the 9 spot. I would imagine it was just random, but I could be wrong. So, I'm just...
How's draft prep going for you?
I'm just someone who should know every intricacy whatsoever of the rules in the draft process, and I've been stumped a couple times by your questions, Robert. So
there's a lot going on.
I still have time to do a deep dive. You know, I got some calls today. Of course, I've done my rankings and kind of done the whole process of everything. But there's still a little bit of work to be done, and you know, I've been on the phone a little bit with some players, just kind of checking on some things and figuring out how what everyone's mindset is and availability. And we're gonna make it happen. And as silly as it sounds, I think fantasy baseball is gonna come in big handy especially in the premier draft. That's an auction style. So it's going to be an exciting couple of days, and straight from the draft right into the North Carolina Open. So it's going to be cool. It's always nice to make your picks and then kind of see how they perform pretty quickly, you know? So yeah. It's not going to take long. You're going to see how it looks. And of course, one tournament, but it's always fun to do that, to get your squad and then kind of check them out and see how they do.
Greg Dowd mentioned one thing about, well, he's had baby fever for a while. You know, he sees little AJ and he's like, I've got 6 months to get somebody pregnant. Because last year in Mesa at MLP, when we were on the Brooklyn Aces, he was like, man, I have baby fever so bad. I just want, and he doesn't have a girlfriend. He hasn't had a girlfriend the whole year. So, but he's like, by the end of 18 months, I will be, he said a father, but he just meant like, he will be getting somebody pregnant.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I gotcha.
So he's like, man, I've got the clock's ticking. I've got, what is it? A few months now. But he did mention, based on the baby fever thing, that he's seen Scarpa. It's happened to Scarpa where he had a kid and then, you know, switch flips where he's just like, you're playing for something bigger than yourself now. And just wanted to say, I think sleeper in this draft is DJ Young. He just, you know, big congrats to him and his partner on their new baby. Very cute. But DJ's got something bigger than himself now. So watch out for Maybe. Mr. Young.
It's the tweak that he needed to take him to the next level. We know he's got the shots. So maybe that shots. Just that mental umph that he got from, you know, bringing like life into the world is
going to
get him over that hump. Ooh. Must provide. Robert, this was lovely. And I think we chatted about.
MLP's leading right into, was it Cary? Is that where the event's at?
Yeah, Cary. 15 minutes from me, I get to sleep in my own bed, which is pretty.
Adam Stone's dream.
Yeah, it's the only tournament of the year. There's a couple I can drive to from here, but mostly it's pretty heavy travel. So yeah, so we got really two of the main things for the tournament and Cary is McGuffin and Ignatowicz are back. So both missed a handful of tournaments. I believe it was a foot and a shoulder for Tyson and James respectively, and so that's pretty exciting stuff to get them back. Tyson, clear-cut fan favorite, and Ignatowicz, you know, bringing that power and some really great results over the last 6 months, so great to have them back.
Yep. Is Tyson and Deckel playing?
I believe that is correct, yes.
And then James and Matt Wright?
I believe they are back in business, yes. So interesting in women's doubles, as well as Lucy Kovalova and Callie Smith are not playing together. I believe Lucy is with Jackie Kawamoto. And let's see here. Don't have it here. So that's... Leia Jansen and Callie Smith. So, I mean,
okay.
I can't even remember the last time those two were not on court together. I mean, it's got to be 2+ years at this point in gender doubles for those two. So
I like those switch ups. So that's, I think it's great for both of them. Honestly, I think it'll be Lucy, Jackie. I think they have the potential to do really well, and Callie and Leia as well.
Yeah. So that's an interesting look for sure. Oh, look at that, and the defending medalists from men's doubles. The Rattlesnake and the Canadian Beaver, Steve Deakin, with a nice little bronze medal last year in this event.
Oh, yeah.
I did not know that.
That's one of my favorite interviews that I've seen Steve Deakin do. That was last year.
Tell me about it. I love Stevie D.
It was last year at North Carolina, yeah. He played with Travis, and then I think they played Tyler Leung and somebody. I don't remember who Leung played with, but... You know, after they won that, clearly. And then Deakin during the interview was just like, look, we were going to make Tyler Dink, and it was going to be up to him to win or lose it for them. And we won. Yeah. He was like, the plan was to make Tyler Dink, and that's what we did. And here we are. We won.
Here we are. And, that's good stuff right there. Oh, we got Thomas Wilson and Alshon back together as a 5 seed, and they could face the Jonzai in the quarterfinals. That's quite a quarterfinal matchup right there. And then let's see. Oh, shocking defending medalist in women's doubles, Waters and Parento.
But honestly, that's that Christian and Thomas matchup, you know, I talked about kind of that strategy with like the Zane and Alshon when they got that upset. is I hope Thomas and Christian don't just stack on the same side the whole time. I hope they on returns don't switch off the returns. Even if that's just how you play, you can stack on your serve, but like just don't switch. I just think, Alshon's doing really good stuff off the bounce. I think he's worked on his disguise and he's finding a lot of holes. That's a dangerous quarter for the Johns.
Yeah, no, the forehand off the bounce from Alshon is ridiculous.
It's gotten much better.
Yeah, and the backhand is very much less there, but he's so athletic, it doesn't really matter. It's like he can almost speed up off the bounce with the forehand over 75% of the court because he's got that movement to get back to where he needs to be. So, yeah, Zane can do it on both sides extremely well, and I think Thomas and Alshon are much more pigeonholed into that forehand speed up, but they're such freak athletes and they move so well, it almost doesn't matter at that point because they can hit forehands from anywhere. So that's I mean that's a very dangerous team, especially early, as they can catch fire as well as anyone, and I do not expect them to full stack. Maybe a half stack situation, but I think the fluidity of both of them on both sides is completely fine. And keep him out of those patterns that we always talk about. So, let's see here. Just a couple storylines. We got some mixed doubles here. We got Julian and Paris Todd. I don't know if we've seen that one before, but that's possible. And Parento and Sock back again. They have not had the results they were hoping for the last couple tournaments. Let's see if they can turn that around. And then, of course, the clear-cut two seed that they've earned it is James and Anna. And I just hope he's fully healthy and can slap those head high and shoulder high forehands because he's going to need to. And basically both gender and mixed doubles being that left side stud with Matt Wright and then clearly in mixed doubles. So I think there's some fun stuff going on in North Carolina.
I talked to James a little bit about his kind of goals for 2020 and he thinks it's realistic that he says to get to number one in men's is probably a little bit of a stretch this year. But he wants to kind of, his goal for 2024 is to be the kind of the clear cut number two in men's and the number one in mixed. And he thinks that's doable. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's reasonable. He's got the skill set. He's got the desire. He's got the work ethic. Maybe he trains too many hours on court given the shoulder injury. But I mean, anyone with that skill set and that drive and, you know, being in his mid-20s and just kind of letting it fly, I think that's very reasonable. I mean,
dude, I didn't realize he's only 23.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's like, what else is he doing? Nothing.
Yeah.
He's hanging out with Anna and he's drilling and playing and, you know, meditating and locking in visually about what goals he wants to have and what he wants to do. Of course he can do it. So I would say probably the men's doubles is the more difficult of those two. As the mixed doubles, he covers a lot of court and he hits the ball very hard. No one can take either one of those away from James Ignatowicz. So I think it's a reasonable statement.
Yep. So we got obviously, good MLP recap. We got the North Carolina PPA coming up. We've got, I'm returning to action this week, Adam. I'm going to see how the body holds up. I'm playing the APP down in Delray. It got mixed on Friday, men's with Mr. Eric Lang on Saturday.
Oh, it's Lang thing.
It's Lang season, you know? So that'll be fun on my end. Going to drive down tomorrow and try to get some practice because I have not been practicing.
Well, hey, well, be ready because Lang going to be speeding it up. So you better be ready with the hands on the next ball. Lang's going to let it fly. No, that's good stuff. Always hoping for the best for you, especially physically. Hopefully it's a smooth transition back on the court. Look at us. I think we're just under an hour. That's what it's hard. Once we get on here, Rob, we got so much to talk about. We like looking at each other and sometimes it gets a little over that.
Where's the time at?
It's in the top right corner. It says 56, and we had a slight interaction with Kryn Carr there when the baby that we're going to have to
keep in this podcast.
We're going to have to edit that out. there might have been a raising of the voice somewhere between us, but you know that's life with the baby, and that's okay.
It's healthy. It's all good stuff.
I mean, yeah.
It's edit. It's all in love. Let's leave it. Josh, you know what to do. Leave it.
Just a bunch of love. That's right. But yeah, no, great stuff. And it'll be, I mean, we'll have the recap for North Carolina next week, and tons of information from the draft that we can kind of pick apart. So good stuff.
And yeah, thank you for listening. Obviously, Selkirk puts this on for us. We appreciate them. And we'd love to hear what you guys think in the comments about MLP, about little AJ, about Prof, how Prof and I are going to be on the pod soon lighting Adam up, because that's my favorite pastime. And yeah, appreciate you guys. Oh my God, that smile. Oh my God, he's so cute.
My guy. Lovely. Good stuff, buddy.
Okay, next time.